Good morning. Happy Tuesday. It's now time to read the Des Moines Register for Tuesday, February 20th. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of Iowans with a print disability. I'm Nicole Tam, and my partner at the microphone for the next 90 minutes is Deanna Snyder. For the first hour, we'll be covering local and national news from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. And then the second hour, we'll start with birthdays and obituaries, followed by opinions, sports, and lifestyle news. We'll then wrap up our broadcast with Dear Abby. Support for today's reading comes from the Des Moines Register and donations from individuals and listeners like you. Learn how you can keep the volunteer voices of IRIS going strong at iowaradioreading.org. Now let's take a quick look at the weather and the headlines from today's Des Moines Register, and then we'll go right into those articles. Weather-wise, it's another warm stretch for the day, mostly sunny and mild today. Winds southwest at 6 to 12 miles an hour. Partly cloudy tonight, winds south-southwest at 6 to 12 miles an hour. The high today will be at 55 degrees. The low is at 35. Definitely not normal this time of year. We're usually in the teens in February still, but I'm sure a lot of us are enjoying the warmer stretch. And then the rest of the week looks like it'll be in the 50s for a high. And on Sunday and Monday, my goodness, the highs just keep going higher. 62 is a high on Sunday and 68 on Monday. Just a lot of sunshine and breezy a little bit as we head towards the end of the week, mostly just mild. And with that, here's Deanna with the first article in our Des Moines Register. There are quite a few headlines. So, Deanna, you want to get started?
Thank you, Nicole. Okay. It's morning. The sun is setting on Park Art. The Art Center cites safety upkeep for plan to remove Greenwood Pond. This is from Paris Barraza. Patricia Prietel has frequented Greenwood Park in Des Moines for the past 4 years. It's tranquil at the park, tucked past the Des Moines Art Center off 45th Street. Visitors are greeted with a multitude of trees, barren during the winter, trails and sloped hills that lead to little discoveries. There's an amphitheater, for example, or a great view of a pond, a sight Prietel particularly enjoys. But that view changed last October when fencing enclosed certain areas of the park to restrict visitors' access. And the view will change again later this year. For 28 years, Greenwood Park has been home to an outdoor art installation that is owned and managed by the Des Moines Art Center. The park's visitors have used the installation for years, knowingly or not. The art installation, titled Greenwood Pond Double Site, and created from 1989 to 1996, includes elements such as walkways that visitors have used to walk around the edge of the pond at the park. There's a pavilion, some of which had roofing that sheltered visitors from the elements or provided shade, depending on the season. There's also a trough that visitors could descend into and be treated to a unique view of the water closer to eye level. Greenwood Park, Greenwood Pond Double Site was an important work for New York-based artist Mary Miss and involved several Iowa organizations and years of effort during its inception. What resulted was a $1.5 million investment from the Art Center, and art that melded into nature and could engage people with the environment and the Art Center. Nearly three decades later, the art installation will be removed from the park in 2024 due to what Art Center leaders say is the threat it poses to public safety and the high price involved in rebuilding and caring for it, a long-term cost that would surpass the Art Center's $7.7 million annual budget last year. But its removal has raised questions for Miss and captured national attention. An engineering report from last year found that the installation's original choice of materials, placement in an unstable aquatic environment, and exposure to Iowa's severe climate contributed to its ongoing structural integrity problems and public safety issues, according to a letter from the Des Moines Art Center to Miss. The Art Center provided a copy to the Des Moines Register. Miss told the Register in January regarding her communications with Des Moines Art Center Director Kelly Baum about the state of Greenwood Park double site. She said, "I never thought it was a question of removing that work." She had hoped for a better path forward in dealing with the installation's future, one that wouldn't involve removing it. But efforts to dismantle what remains of Greenwood Park double site will begin in spring, Director of External Affairs Amy Day said in an email to the Register. And what's to come of the park will be an answer years in the making. Priatel has one idea. Preserve whatever can be preserved of the art installation. She said it's just impressive that Des Moines did this. And I would like Des Moines to build on that past with whatever they need to do in the future to keep it safe. But keep that organic sense. Keep it integrated with nature. In December, Baum notified Miss of the decision of decommission her art installation at Greenwood Park. She and Baum had been in communication about Greenwood Pond double site previously, prompted by a structural review of the installation of that called for immediate action from the Arts Center in October due to public safety concerns. That led to closing off public access to certain portions of the installation and the removal of several elements of it. All of this took place several months after Baum began her position as director in May, replacing former director Jeff Fleming, who held his position for more than two decades. But what has come from the structural review and the communication with the Arts Center that ensued left Miss with questions. What is reasonable maintenance of the art? Has that occurred over its lifetime? Baum said the installation has received consistent investment of human and financial resources since it opened. The Arts Center points to several examples of maintenance, including $17,000 in repairs for a footbridge in 2022. Per the Arts Center's records, repairs were made to numerous sections of the works cantilevered bridge and various walkways, whose timbers have been eroded and destabilized by the impact of extreme weather, including ice and flooding, said Day in an email to the Register. And in 2015, the Arts Center raised $467,000 to replace and repair the boardwalk, wooden art structures, and the submerged observation platform, the Register reported in 2016. Miss is especially surprised that after those repairs, Greenwood Pond double site would need to be removed now. Before that, Day said, Miss was engaged with an inventory and rehabilitation plan that resulted in repairs to Greenwood Pond double site in 2014 to 2015. In addition to Art Center staff taking action as needed for maintenance of the installation, the Art Center has also commissioned assessments from conservators, structural engineers, and landscape architects over the artwork's history, said Baum. According to an open letter from Baum published to the Art Center's website on February 3rd, the museum commissioned seven reports over nearly 30 years. Baum said, each one of those larger assessments, which itself requires us to direct resources towards it, each one of those assessments has pointed to the same series of contributing factors, which is that a work of art was placed in an unstable aquatic environment made with ephemeral materials with a lifespan of 10 to 12 years. Baum said engineering design not really meant to withstand the local weather, the extreme climates, and this has contributed to its rapid decline. The boardwalk pavilion and the arched structures in Greenwood Pond double site developed dry rot in the original wood timbers and are severely compromised, according to the letter to Miss from the Art Center. Treated lumber, concrete, and wire mesh make up the artwork, Miss said. The wood that makes up the majority of Greenwood Pond double site has a lifespan of 10 to 12 years, according to the Art Center's letter. Miss told the Register in January that she wondered if replacing everything is necessary, or if different portions of the installation could be replaced over time. She also wants to look at fundraising possibilities available. But Baum said maintenance is no longer an option for Greenwood Pond double site. The cost to rebuild the art installation was estimated at $2.7 million in November. Baum estimated that overall the cost of redesigning the artwork and the need to hire new staff, including a dedicated fundraiser, registrar, curator, and facilities associate to care for it in perpetuity, would require a large endowment to fund its care and maintenance every year. Baum puts that at about $8 million investment. The Des Moines Arts Center's annual budget was $7.7 million last year, Baum said. Fundraising itself is an investment of resources and time, she said. And the mission of the Arts Center is that we serve hundreds of thousands of people in the greater Des Moines area. We have thousands of works of art to care for, three buildings, the sculpture park, and it is not feasible to direct so much of our energy and so many of our modest resources toward the rebuild of a single work of art that we have and are proud to have cared for 30 years. The origins of Greenwood Pond Doublesite began in 1989. MIST was invited by then Art Center Director Julia Brown Terrell to choose a site for a project and came across the pond at Greenwood Park, which MIST recalled as not being in good shape then, but seemingly open to many possibilities. The location became a place to build a demonstration wetland, inspired by visits to bogs and sloughs across Iowa, and by what she had learned about the removal of many of them and how that had affected the land. Greenwood Pond Doublesite, in the high-visibility location of a Des Moines park, could engage people with some of the difficult environmental issues we face, said Miss. The project combined the efforts of the Art Center, the Des Moines Founders Garden Club, the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation, the Polk County Conservation Board, the Science Center of Iowa, and the city, according to Register Archives. Miss said, I think that Julia and I shared this idea that a museum, a cultural institution, could have a leadership role in addressing issues like this that didn't have to be just the realm of policymakers and scientists and educators, that cultural institutions could have a role, she said. My whole career has been kind of devoted to this idea that engaging people in the public realm is the most important thing that I can do as an artist. A month after Miss learned of what she called the shocking news about her installation being decommissioned by the Art Center, a nonprofit, the Cultural Landscape Foundation, publicized those plans. This wasn't the first time the nonprofit had called attention to this particular work. In 2014, the Cultural Landscape Foundation published a report that details landscapes that are at risk. It included Greenwood Pond Doublesite, though repairs made by the Art Center afterward led to the nonprofit considering the installation saved, Charles A. Birnbaum, founder and president of the Cultural Landscape Foundation, said in January. Since the latest news of the pending decommissioning of the art, 38 people, including artists, architects, and educators, wrote letters of support for MIS and Greenwood Pond Doublesite as of February 19th. That includes two individuals familiar with the Des Moines Art Center, M. Jessica Rowe, former deputy director of the Art Center, and later director of the Greater Des Moines Public Art Foundation, and Deborah Leviton, former Art Center curator. The Art Center's policy on decommissioning is similar to its policy for deaccessioning, or removal of a piece from its collection. The latter is governed by the principles of the Association of Art Museum Directors' Professional Practices and is relied on to guide decisions on deinstallation and decommission. Baum said those protocols relate to physical conditions, so works of art that are damaged beyond reasonable repair. They also provide for works of art that cannot be cared for adequately and continue to need special treatment. And we also include their health and human safety, works of art that have become hazard to the public. So what's next for Greenwood Park? In some ways, the Des Moines Park will see no change. Birds will still chirp as they flutter from tree to tree. Community members will still visit for a walk or to admire nature, and it'll remain a park just a few miles from downtown Des Moines. Ben Page, Des Moines Parks and Rec Director, told the Register in February that Greenwood Park will be restored to what it was prior to the existence of Mrs. Art installation, assuming the Art Center proceeds with deinstallation. From there, city park planners will determine what the future of the park could be. Page imagines that people will want to interact with the pond. She shared other thoughts. Incorporate a trail system around the pond, some seating in the park, and maybe some historic signature that would inform visitors of what was previously at the park, and give a nod to Miss's work. The public will be included in this process, and then his department will propose budgets. Page emphasized that this will take years. Like Priatel, another of Greenwood Park's visitors has a suggestion. Samantha Thorpe, who came to Iowa in 1992 and has remained since, lives in the Waterbury neighborhood. She walks to the park nearly every weekend with her dog and has been taking her two children there for about 16 years. Mrs. Installation, which she described as innovative, was one of the reasons she'd go to the park, after all, to see the work. That and to pursue her photography at a great site for beautiful photos. You still need to have some type of interactive option, probably made from a material that's more durable, Thorpe said of the future of Greenwood Park. Visitors to the park should still have a way to walk around the pond in the way Mrs. Pathway has provided, said Thorpe. She'd also like to see an element for children to interact with. Whether Greenwood Pond double site will continue to remain owned by the Art Center following its removal from the park will be decided with the board and in consultation with Miss, said Baum. Miss said in January she has not considered what she'll do next if the Art Center moves forward with removing the artwork. Baum said installation of the artwork and its long presence in the park should be looked on with pride. The Art Center showed such extraordinary ambition and forethought when they commissioned this work from Mary, and to have been willing to take the risks that they did when they did, and to have been willing to invest $1.5 million, and this is the 1990s, to have been willing to invest $1.5 million in a brilliant idea by Mary Miss, the Art Center should be proud. The Garden Club should be proud. The city should be proud. All of our landscape architects, partners, Science Center. We should be really proud of what we did for ourselves and for Mary. Baum described land and environmental art as needing the outdoors, but simultaneously being endangered by it. Though a lot of people wanted Greenwood Pond double site to be permanent, it was made with ephemeral materials, Baum said. I know that there's something to be learned from this experience, she said. There's a discussion that we can have around the relationship between climate, publicly cited art, the relationship that we can have around equitable or not, distribution of resources towards women artists.
And our next story is about couple fights check fraud with an Iowa bank. $105,000 removed from the Decay's account. This is from Tyler Jett of the Des Moines Register. Sam Decay was enjoying a calm fall morning in his Manhattan, New York apartment when an email came through. First Whitney Bank and Trust in his hometown of Atlantic, Iowa, informed him that $9,950 had been debited from his account. Thank you for your business, read that email. It was sent at 8:29 in the morning on October 10th. But Decay, 75 years old, says that he had not made any payments or cut any checks from that account, which he inherited from his mother when she died in February of 2023. Confused, Decay called the bank, where employees pulled up a scan of a cashier's check that had been written by an April McGilvera. McGilvera? The check had Decay's account number at the bottom, and at the top, it read Whitney Bank and Trust. It's an incorrect name for that bank. Decay says that the employees told him that someone must have committed fraud. It was the beginning of a mystery that points to what experts say is a growing problem. The next morning, Decay received two more emails from the bank. Thank you for your business, it says, the first, informing him that at 8:39 in the morning, that his account had been debited for $50,000 and $500. The other email said the same thing. Thank you for your business. It was sent at the same time, informing him that he was out another $45,250. Scans of two more checks that's written by someone identified as Alan Cortez looked almost identical to the first, with the same incorrect name for the bank. Decay says that First Whitney has replaced the $105,000 that he lost, but still, 4 months later, the case perplexes him. Of all people, Decay has a particular interest in crimes like these. He spent his career protecting companies from fraud, retiring as vice president for information security at the BNY Mellon International Investment Firm. He says it becomes more of a detective story, more of a forensic tale. Decay's story is not one of a victim taking justice into his own hands, tapping his decades of experience to track a criminal and extracting revenge. But rather, Decay reported the fraud to the Iowa Division of Banking. He says that First Whitney employees told him that they also would investigate the case. From his apartment overlooking the Hudson River, he recently told the Des Moines Register that he doesn't know what came of this case. The Division of Banking has not yet contacted him since October, and a spokesperson for the agency told the Register that state laws ban employees from publicly disclosing details of investigations. First Whitney CEO Paul Goode, likewise, declined to comment on the details of Decay's case. He said in an email, "Our staff continues to try and educate our customers, and we have been able to stop a wide variety of scams from phishing to bogus phone calls seeking personal information. The thieves are innovative." Spokespeople at the Atlantic Police Department, the Cass County Sheriff's Office, and the Cass County Attorney's Office said they had not received a report of a check fraud at First Whitney. Asked why he didn't report the case to law enforcement there, Decay says the issue seems too technical for Atlantic Police. From his career in banking, Decay says that he was surprised by the nature of this crime. He has long contemplated cyber attacks, with hackers extracting hundreds of thousands of dollars without fingerprints. He says this was an old-fashioned sort of fraud. But the old-fashioned is back in vogue. Banking experts say that check fraud cases more than doubled in Iowa from 2020 to 2023. This is according to the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, a division of the U.S. Treasury. Banks across the country have experienced a similar trend. Banking and criminal justice officials say they aren't quite sure why check fraud has become more frequent since the pandemic. But Julie Gleha, Vice President of Regulatory Compliance at the Iowa Bankers Association, said that criminals returned their focus to checks after companies and regulators took steps to protect debit and credit card transactions. Gleha said in an email, "If they can get just a few checks through the system, they most likely can make a lot more money than several smaller debit card transactions." Paul Benda, the Vice President of Risk, Fraud, and Cybersecurity at the American Bankers Association, told a Senate committee on February 1st that criminals are stealing checks from the U.S. Postal Service. He said that these fraudsters have stolen master keys and taken several people's mail in bulk. Some have even assaulted mail carriers. Benda says the mail system isn't nearly as secure as we thought. Postal Inspection Service spokesperson Michael Mark told the New York Times back in March that the Postal Service is trying to make its blue mailboxes more secure. Among other fixes, the department will be adding rakes with metal teeth to prevent thieves from reaching inside those boxes. Mike Burke, a senior robbery and crisis management consultant at Waukee-based payment processor Shazam, says that encrypted messaging services like Telegram have now helped criminals organize wide-scale check fraud. He says that fraudsters, quote, wash checks by using chemicals like nail polish remover to strip away pen ink. They can then write a new dollar amount and payee. Alternatively, some fraudsters can also do cooking the checks by designing them online and then printing them on check card stock that they obtain from other countries. Now, once they have the checks, criminals can seek, quote, money mules or walkers in online forums. Those people are willing to cash the checks at banks, often with fake IDs. Burke says it has exploded. I've been in the game for 30 years, and this is the worst I've seen it. Thus far, Decay says that he has been unsatisfied with First Whitney's response to this case. He said that employees have declined to explain how somebody could have received fake cashier checks with his bank account number on them. He says they don't want to talk about it. They really don't. The discussion always suddenly turned into, well, we think maybe a hacker has gained access to your computer, or I think you ought to change your password. It always comes back to Decay and his wife as if we're somehow responsible. He added that he struggles to understand how the problem could have occurred because of his online password. Before he retired, he says that he helped BNY Mellon write policies on how employees could protect the company from hackers, authoring rules about password requirements, encryption, wireless communication, and how employees should handle printed banking material. First Whitney may also not know how the fraud occurred. David Karras, the CEO of Community Bankers of Iowa, it's a trade group, said that small banks can struggle to get information when the larger situation or when the larger institution is involved. He says the smaller community banks tend to work harder to try and catch criminals and find out how the fraud occurred and stop it, and then a lot of the big national banks do. Big banks kind of just budget for it. Decay says that his inheritance of First Whitney account followed the death of his mother, Elizabeth, in February of 2023. He planned to transfer the funds to another account, but he had not gotten around to it by last fall. The bank closed his account and gave him a new one after that fraud. At the beginning of February this year, he said, a First Whitney employee called him to say that the bank detected another fraud attempt. This time, he said, somebody tried to wire money out of his account. He said the bank caught it, shut down that account, and gave him a new one. That's his third account in 4 months. He says he has transferred all but $10,000 out of the First Whitney account. He said of holding on to that account, there was kind of a hometown pride to it. Now, of course, that's very much gone. So the point of this is, how do you not fall victim to check fraud? Sarah Grano, a spokesperson for the American Banking Association, provides this information below about check fraud and how you can prevent it. Criminals steal paper checks that sent through the mail, such as by phishing them from the U.S. Postal Service mailboxes, or simply by taking them out of your personal mailbox. They may even rob postal workers in search of these checks. Now, once they have a check that you wrote and mailed, they use chemicals to, quote, wash the check to change the amount or make themselves the payee. They then deposit your check and steal money from your account. But if you have mailed a check that was paid, but the receiver never received it, you may be a check washing victim. So how do you protect yourself? Consider making payments using e-checks, ACH automatic payments, and other electronic and or mobile payments. You can also try using pens with indelible ink, that's black ink, so it's more difficult to wash the check. If you're donating to a charity or other businesses, you can also call or just reach out to them to make sure they received your check. Also use online banking to review copies of your checks to make sure they're not altered. If you still receive paychecks back from the bank, shred them, don't just trash them. And also regularly review your bank activity and statements for errors, and don't leave blank spaces in the payee or amount lines of the checks that you write. From the Postal Inspection Services, they recommend that you drop off mail in blue collection boxes before the last scheduled pickup time or directly inside the local post office. And regularly check your mail. Don't leave your mail in your mailbox overnight. And if you plan to head out of town, have the post office hold your mail or ask a trusted friend or neighbor to pick up your mail. Now, unfortunately, if you do fall victim, make sure you're filing a report immediately with the U.S. Postal Inspection Service. The website is uspis.gov/report, or you can call this phone number, 1-877-876-2455. You can also reach out to your local police department or your financial institution. Hopefully this is helpful for you, and now we'll turn things over back to Deanna.
Thank you, Nicole. All right, I'm going to move over to Metro in Iowa. Teamsters protest is planned at Iowa Capitol. The union warns about the possibility of rolling strikes. This is from Kevin Baskins of Des Moines Register. After years of contending that its bargaining clout for public employees is being eroded by the Iowa legislature, the Teamsters Union is planning to showcase its displeasure as well as its solidarity at the Iowa Capitol on Wednesday. The union also is leaving the door open for the possibility of rolling strikes, with Teamsters Local 238 Secretary Treasurer Jesse Case saying it is raising money to offset any fines that might occur from striking. Striking is prohibited for public employees in Iowa, among those whose unions the Teamsters are prominent. Case said in a prepared statement, "You can't legislate movement out of existence. Union-busting legislators need to know that strikes are legal in the private sector, and we are raising money to offset their punitive fines while we contemplate rolling strikes in the public sector. The only way to avoid disrupting business in Iowa is to not disrupt workers' rights." Rolling strikes are a labor action in which some union workers strike while others continue to work, and are used to conserve strike funds while also making labor actions unpredictable for employers. Reinforced by six Teamsters locals from Iowa and three other states, Minnesota, Illinois, and Nebraska, the union is planning what it's calling Teamsters Caravan around the Capitol on Wednesday. Overall, the Teamsters represent more than 5,000 Iowa workers, according to unionfacts.com. The Iowa Senate is expected to take up a controversial bill affecting public sector unions this week. The proposal is the latest legislation drawing the ire of organized labor and affects required recertification elections for bargaining units representing public employees. The bill would amend legislation passed in 2017 that requires the bargaining units to hold a recertification vote about 10 months before the expiration of their existing contracts, allowing members to say whether they want to continue to be represented by the union. The new measure would require the employer, such as a state agency, county street department, city sanitation department, or police department, or a school, to provide a list of employees in the bargaining unit within 10 days of receiving notice from the Iowa Public Employee Relations Board, PERB, of recertification election. Under existing rules, the lists must be submitted before recertification votes. If an employer fails to submit it, the vote isn't held and contracts are approved without them. Under the proposed law, if the employer fails to submit the list within 5 days, the Employee Relations Board will immediately decertify the union. The union will then need to petition a district court to require the employer to submit the list. Unions opposed the measures in subcommittee and committee hearings, despite their opposition and one of the majority Republican members joining Democratic members to voting against it. The Senate Workforce Committee, late February 14th, advanced the bill to the full Senate. The vote came after more than 2 hours of debate and 11 failed attempts by Democrats to amend the bill. Last week, Case posted a strongly worded video on YouTube accusing Republican lawmakers of union busting and vowing action. He said, "We're not taking it. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to take the fight to them. We're going to take the fight to their town, to their county, to their farm, to their business. We're going to have rolling strikes across the state of Iowa." Senator Adrian Dickey, Republican from Packwood, chair of the Iowa Senate Workforce Committee, in a statement Sunday, dismissed the Teamsters' planned actions as simply continuing their long-standing opposition to jobs and freedom. The unions saw their bargaining power reduced in the 2017 legislature, with a bill that left many public sector employees with only the ability to negotiate wages, leaving high insurance benefits and work condition issues up to employers. In their news release announcing the Capitol rally, the Teamsters say that in 2017, corporate-owned politicians decided that snowplow drivers, sanitation workers, school bus drivers, teachers, nurses, and other public servants shouldn't have a voice on the job, and the results have been devastating, from declining wages and benefits to staffing shortages and soaring turnover in our schools and public services. But these attacks haven't been enough for some Iowa legislators. Now, some state legislators are proposing an additional union-busting legislation. Republicans who backed the bill said in the hearings that the measure addresses backsliding by government agencies that have failed to insist on recertification votes before negotiating new contracts. They say failing to do so denies workers the right to periodically decide whether they want to continue to have union representation. The Teamsters' new release also singles out Dickey, the Senate Workforce Committee chair, as leading the union busting at the Iowa State Capitol, saying legislation passed during his tenure has included weakening child labor laws, union busting, and a passage of a bill that limits tort liability on commercial vehicles, a measure the Teamsters say benefits the trucking company he owns. Dickey, however, fired back at the Teamsters in a statement on Monday. He said, "The Teamsters are nothing more than a special interest group opposing common sense opportunity for Iowa youth, freedom of representation, and pro-jobs policies. Observers of Iowa's political process know they are simply continuing their long-standing opposition to jobs and freedom," Dickey wrote. He also defended the changes made to labor laws and the one currently under consideration. Dickey wrote, "The bill that they are using as a rallying cry is nothing more than a technical cleanup to legislation that was passed in 2017. Last year, 41% of Iowa public sector workers that had union representation did not have a voice due to a loophole in the legislation passed in 2017. If the public sector employer, the union, are following the law, nothing will change for them," Dickey wrote. Referring to the bill that lowered minimum ages for certain kinds of employment, he wrote that Last year's Youth Employment Opportunities Bill simply added some flexibility for 14 to 17-year-olds who may want to have a part-time job after school or in the summer. Yet, once again, unions misrepresented that bill by calling it a child slave labor bill. When anyone who read the bill and had 2 ounces of common sense understood it was merely aligning Iowa law with the school and extracurricular routines of Iowa youth. Iowans understood that truth, which is why the bill was widely supported by the majority of Iowa parents, according to a Des Moines Register poll. Dickey also said the tort liability reforms actually helped Teamsters drivers, and that the union regrets not being able to take credit for passing. Let's see who's saying this. Okay, Dickey said, last year, tort reform was passed that affected thousands of Iowa employers, certainly not just for myself. Fact is that legislation helped Teamsters drivers because it shifted liability that their drivers would have been exposed to if they caused an accident, and placed the liability on their employer. The Teamsters did nothing to help their members on that bill. Now attack me for helping pass this legislation only because it was a good thing for their members that the union brass can't take credit for, he wrote. Nationally, the Teamsters enjoyed high-profile success in summer of 2023 when they were able to successfully negotiate a new contract with United Parcel Services, Incorporated, gaining increases in wages and the creation of more full-time jobs, as well as a number of workplace protections and improvements. A Gallup poll released in August of 2023 found that 67% of Americans approve of unions, a proportion that has been steadily rising since 2009. The Gallup poll also found 77% now say that unions mostly help rather than hurt union members. Today's reading is up 7 percentage points from 2016 and 11 points from 2009, and essentially ties the prior high of 76% in 2003. Also, the Gallup poll found a record high 47% now believe unions help rather than hurt non-union workers, well above 38% in 2016. That's tied to the prior high in 2005. They also found a record high 61% saying unions help rather than hurt the U.S. economy, eclipsing the prior high from 1999 by 6 percentage points. Also, it found 57%, roughly matching the prior high, saying unions mostly help the companies where workers are unionized. Despite the rising pro-union sentiment, unions representing about 8.8% of Iowa's workers in 2023, less than half the 20% represented by bargaining units in 1990, according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. Collective bargaining for Iowa public employees started in 1974 under then-Governor Robert Ray, a Republican. In return for their rights to negotiate wages, benefits, and working conditions, public employees surrendered the ability to strike. Critics of legislation, they say, has reduced collective bargaining rights in recent years point to the spirit of promoting harmonious and cooperative relationships between government and its employees, a goal stated in Chapter 20 of Iowa Code, they contend is being usurped by continued reduction of the ability of unions to effectively negotiate on behalf of workers. Nicole.
Deanna, thanks. Next in the Metro and Iowa section, court ruling, leaving kids home wasn't a crime. Iowa justices weigh in on an endangerment case. This is from William Morris of the Des Moines Register. A Waterloo mother did not break any laws when she left her children at home while she was grocery shopping, the Iowa Supreme Court says. The mother, Paula Cole, had been charged with and convicted of child endangerment after she left 5 children, ages 5 to 12, sleeping in her apartment one day in 2021 and then drove to Walmart. While she was away, several of the children awoke and began arguing, resulting in her 9-year-old daughter storming out of the building. A neighbor followed the girl out and testified that she never left the property, but the child's upset older brother called police. When Cole returned from the store, she was charged with endangering the children. In its unanimous decision overturning the conviction on Friday, the Supreme Court focused on the language of the statute that requires that in order to be convicted of endangerment, a parent must be found to have, quote, created a substantial risk to the child's health or safety. Justice David May wrote for the court that there's no evidence that Cole did any such thing. Usually, creating a substantial risk requires some illegal or otherwise abusive behavior, May wrote. While a parent beating a child or engaging in unsafe driving with children in the vehicle clearly creates a risk of harm, it's a different matter to leave one's children home alone in an access-secured apartment, even if a child might theoretically leave the apartment, cross the street, and then get hit by a car. May wrote, a parent does not create a risk if that risk is part of background risk of ordinary life. Rather, a risk is created by a parent when that parent's behavior produces an identifiable risk that falls outside the range of risks that accompany ordinary life. May also pointed out that nearly any choice a parent makes could result in harm befalling their child. Playing football or climbing on playground equipment could result in an engage in fun, social activities risk that other forms of harm. A parent who chooses to let a child walk to school might fear the child's abduction by a stranger, but a parent who drives the child to school exposes them to the greater risk of injury in the vehicle crash, May wrote. Iowa law does not set a minimum age at which children can be left home alone, and in Cole's case, the court questioned whether the children would have been safer going to the store with her. May wrote, no evidence shows that leaving the kids home was any riskier than driving them to Walmart, even assuming that she had a vehicle that big. The court's decision narrows the scope of state law that some prosecutors had constructed more broadly. In 2022, Johnson County prosecutors charged an Iowa City man with child endangerment after he went drinking with colleagues and then later fell asleep or passed out at home with his 9-year-old daughter in that house. The defendant, who lost his job as a high school administrator after being charged, was acquitted by a jury in less than 30 minutes. The court on Friday did not categorically rule out future prosecutions based on leaving children at home alone, but suggests that there might be aggravating circumstances. May pointed to prior cases in which parents locked up a child without food or left a severely intoxicated teen with a head injury without adult supervision. Cole's attorney, Ellen Newell, praised this ruling. Newell says in an email, my client is pleased with the court's decision and the outcome of her case. The Supreme Court's decision provides helpful guidance for child endangerment charging decisions and also prosecutions.
Thank you, Nicole. Iowa native is to be inducted into the Astronaut Hall of Fame. David Hilmers spent 493 hours in space during his career. This is from Paris Baraza of the Des Moines Register. An Iowa native will be inducted into the U.S. Astronaut Hall of Fame this year. David Hilmers, born in Clinton, and Marsha Ivins will join the 107 astronauts who are part of the Hall of Fame with a ceremony scheduled for June 1st, according to a news release. These two veterans of the space program have demonstrated outstanding accomplishments in furthering NASA's mission of exploration and discovery, said Kurt Brown, board chairman of the Astronaut Scholarship Foundation, which stewards the selection process. Both Hilmers and Ivins represent the committed spirit of exploration, bravery, and teamwork that make our space program a continued success. We are proud and honored to have them join the ranks of the space pioneers recognized in the U.S. Astronaut Hall of Fame at Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex. So who is David Hilmers? Born in Clinton in 1950, Hilmers considers DeWitt his hometown, according to the news release. The Iowa native worked for NASA for 12 years, logging 493 hours in space over the course of four missions. The Des Moines Register reported that in 2021. He was selected as an astronaut in 1980, previously enlisting in the U.S. Marine Corps and attending Naval Postgraduate School in California. His roles at NASA included shuttle software testing, extravehicular activity suit development, or the kind of suit used for spacewalks, according to NASA. Capsule communicator for six shuttle flights and is operating as the head of the mission development branch of the astronaut office. Hilmers flew on several missions, including as a mission specialist on STS-51J, The Department of Defense mission marked the first flight of Space Shuttle Atlantis, occurring from October 3rd to the 7th in 1985, according to NASA. He was also part of the 1988 mission that returned American astronauts to space, NASA reported, following the Challenger disaster that killed 7 crew members in an explosion quickly after launch in 1986. Helmers flew as a mission specialist. In February 1992, Helmers retired from NASA and as a colonel in the Marine Corps. Currently, he is a professor of internal medicine and pediatrics at the Houston-based Baylor College of Medicine, according to the news release. His involvement with space continues. He works with NASA as the exploration medicine technical lead for the clinical science team. So what is the U.S. Astronaut Hall of Fame? Inductees are selected by a committee of Hall of Fame astronauts, former NASA officials, flight directors, historians, and journalists. According to the news release, the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex in Florida has displays for the Hall of Famers that visitors can see. Iowans have long contributed their talents and intelligence to make space exploration possible. These individuals include Clayton Anderson, who graduated from Iowa State and completed 6 spacewalks by his retirement in 2013. Laurel Clark, who was born in Ames and spent 15 days, 22 hours, and 20 minutes in space aboard Space Shuttle Columbia, which disintegrated upon re-entering Earth's atmosphere. Walter Cunningham, the Creston-born man who piloted the 11-day Apollo 7 flight in 1968. Dale Gardner, who spent a total of 337 hours in space and considers Clinton his hometown. James Kelly, the Burlington-born astronaut who piloted the Space Shuttle Discovery on flights STS-102 and STS-114. George Pinky Nelson, who flew in several missions during the 1980s and was born in Charles City. Lauren Shriver, the Jefferson-born man who was inducted into the U.S. Astronaut Hall of Fame in 2008. Peggy Whitson, who grew up in Beaconsfield and became the first woman to command the International Space Station. And finally, Raha Shari, the Cedar Falls astronaut who served as commander of the NASA SpaceX Crew 3 mission in 2021. Nicole.
Awesome. Thank you, Deanna. Our final story in the Metro and Iowa section, Des Moines appeals protest suit to the High Court. This is from William Morris of the Des Moines Register. Des Moines police have suffered a string of losses in court over their actions during the George Floyd protests in 2020. Now the city is asking the highest court in the country to weigh in. Attorneys for Des Moines have filed a petition asking the U.S. Supreme Court to reverse a recent appellate court decision denying an officer immunity from liability. The case in question is a lawsuit that's brought by photographer Mark Neeters, who was pepper sprayed, tackled, and arrested while covering the protest near the Iowa Capitol on June 2, 2020. Neeters accused a city and police officer, Brandon Holton, of unlawful seizure, excessive force, and retaliation. A federal district judge ruled for the city in 2022, finding that Holton had arguable probable cause to arrest Neeters. The court found that Holton was shielded by qualified immunity, a doctrine protecting government officials, that includes police, from liability unless the unlawfulness of their actions was, quote, clearly established at the time. But the 8th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, in a 2-1 decision, reversed that ruling in October, finding that if the case went to trial, a jury could conclude that Holton acted unreasonably in several respects, and that it was, quote, clearly established police could not tackle a non-resisting suspect or arrest someone not part of a group believed to have committed crimes. The city has received several unfavorable court rulings and one jury verdict in lawsuits arising from the Floyd protest. This time, though, it's going to the top. Filed on February 7th, the city's petition asked the Supreme Court to overrule the 8th Circuit decision. The petition, filed by city senior litigator John Haroldson, argues the appellate court evaporated probable cause standards by placing an impossible burden on law enforcement and disregarded the Supreme Court's repeated holding that for qualified immunity questions, clearly established must be demonstrated with a high level of specificity. The city argues that based on what Holton knew at the time, he had probable cause to arrest Nieders for failing to disperse despite earlier orders at the Capitol, and that even if he lacked sufficient justification, the appellate court applied far too broad of a test of whether Holton's actions violated clearly established law. The petition says it appears that this court, every 2 to 3 years, has to remind the lower courts about the doctrine of qualified immunity. Now is the time to do that again. Attorney Gina Messimer, who is representing Nieders and a number of other plaintiffs in lawsuits against the city, told the Des Moines Register the city is doubling down on a losing argument. She said in an email, "I'm surprised Des Moines continues to grasp at straws to avoid accountability. There's no shame in admitting an officer made a mistake, taking responsibility, and doing better next time." Filing what's known as a petition for certiorari does not guarantee the Supreme Court will accept it. The High Court agrees to hear only a tiny fraction, only about 1%, of the thousands of cases that it's appealed to it each year. Generally, the court chooses to focus on cases involving novel or consequential legal issues, or where clarity is needed to resolve disputes between different federal circuit courts. In its petition, the city suggests that such a split does exist, and it would be timely for the court to give guidance on how police should respond to protests that grow violent in this era of civil unrest. Nieders will have the chance to file his own brief arguing why the Supreme Court should not take up this case before the justices decide whether to grant certiorari. The deadline for that response, according to the court docket, is on March 11th.
Thank you, Nicole. All right, from the front page, the GOP grows reluctant to confront Putin. Stalled aid to Ukraine is evidence of political shift. This is from Nicholas Riccardi of Associated Press. At about 2 a.m. last Tuesday, Republican Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin stood on the Senate floor and explained why he opposed sending more aid to help Ukraine fend off the invasion launched by 2022 by Russian President Vladimir Putin. Johnson said, "I don't like this reality. Vladimir Putin is an evil war criminal," but he quickly added, "Vladimir Putin will not lose this war." That argument that the Russian president cannot be stopped, so there's no point in using American taxpayer dollars against him, marks a new stage in the Republican Party's growing acceptance of Russian expansionism in the age of Donald Trump. The GOP has been softening its stance on Russia ever since Trump won the 2016 election, following Russian hacking of his Democratic opponents. There are still reasons for the shift. Among them, Putin is holding out as an international champion of the conservative Christian values, and the GOP is growing increasingly skeptical of overseas entanglements. Then there's Trump's personal embrace of the Russian leader. Now the GOP's ambivalence on Russia has stalled additional aid to Ukraine at a pivotal time in the war. The Senate last week passed a foreign aid package that included $16 billion for Ukraine on a 70-29 vote. But Johnson was one of a majority of the Republicans to vote against the bill after their late-night stand to block it. In the Republican-controlled House, Speaker Mike Johnson said his chamber will not be rushed to pass the measure, even as Ukraine's military warns of dire shortages of ammunition and artillery. Many Republicans are openly frustrated that their colleagues don't see the benefits of helping Ukraine. Putin and his allies have banked on democracies wearying of aiding Kyiv, and Putin's GOP critics warn that NATO countries in Eastern Europe could become targets of an emboldened Russia that believes the U.S. won't counter it. "Putin is losing," Republican Senator Tom Tillis of North Carolina said on the floor before Johnson's speech. This is not a stalemate. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky was one of 22 Republican senators to back the package, while 26 opposed it. The divide within the party was on stark display Friday with the prison death of Russian opposition figure and anti-corruption advocate Alexei Navalny, which President Joe Biden and other world leaders blamed on Putin. Trump notably stood aside from that chorus Monday in his first public comment on the matter that referred to Navalny by name. Trump posted on Truth Social that the sudden death of Alexei Navalny has made me more and more aware of what is happening in our country, It is a slow, steady progression with crooked, that's in caps, radical left politicians, prosecutors, and judges leading us down a path to destruction. Nikki Haley, his Republican presidential primary rival, said Monday that Trump is siding with a thug in his embrace of Putin. Tillis responded to Navalny's death by saying in a post, "History will not be kind to those in America who make apologies for Putin and praise Russian autocracy." Johnson, the House Speaker, issued a statement calling Putin a vicious dictator and pledging that he will be met with united opposition, but he did not offer any way forward to passing the aid to Ukraine. Within the Republican Party, skeptics of confronting Russia seem to be gaining ground. Nearly every Republican senator under the age of 55 voted no on this America Last bill, said Missouri Senator Eric Schmidt, who was elected in 2022. He posted this on social media site X after the vote last week. 15 out of 17 elected since 2018 voted no. Things are changing, just not fast enough. Those who oppose additional Ukraine aid bristle at charges that they are doing Putin's homework. They contend they are taking a hard-headed look at whether it's worth spending money to help the country. Alabama Senator Tommy Tuberville said in the Senate floor, "If you oppose a blank check to another country, I guess that makes you a Russian." Representative Matt Gaetz, a leading opponent of Ukraine aid in the House, described the movement as a generational shift in my party, away from neoconservatism toward foreign policy realism. In interviews with voters awaiting to see Trump speak Saturday night in Waterford Township, Michigan, none praised Putin, but none wanted to spend more money confronting him, trusting Trump to handle him. Even before Trump, Republican voters were signaling discontent with overseas conflicts, said Douglas Kringer, the political scientist at Cornell University. Kreiner said, "Some of it may be a bottom-up change in a key part of the Republican base, and part of it reflects Trump's hold on that base and his ability to sway its opinions and policy preferences in dramatic ways." Trump has long praised Putin, calling his invasion of Ukraine smart and savvy, and recalling this month that he had told NATO members who didn't spend enough on defense that he would encourage Russia to do whatever the hell they want to him. Despite the reluctance within the GOP to continue supporting Ukraine, Russia remains deeply unpopular in the USA. A July 2023 Gallup poll found that just 5% had a favorable view of Putin, including 7% of Republicans. But Putin has positioned his country as a symbol of Christian conservatism and resistance to LGBTQ rights while portraying himself as an embodiment of masculine strength. When Putin attacked Ukraine, there was bipartisan condemnation. Even a year ago, most Republicans in Congress pledged support. But around the same time, Trump was lamenting that U.S. leaders were suckers for sending aid. By the fall, the party was divided. Republicans refused to include another round of Ukraine funding in the government spending bill, insisting that Democrats needed to include a border security measure to earn their support. After Trump condemned the compromised border proposal, Republicans sank the bill, leaving Ukraine backers no option but to push the assistance as part of a foreign aid package with additional money for Israel and Taiwan. Nicole.
All right, Deanna, before we get to birthdays, we have time for a quick 50 states. I'll start with the highlight of North Carolina. This is out of Hendersonville, North Carolina. Already a favorite at a local aquarium, the female stingray named Charlotte is now a worldwide celebrity, and for a good reason. She's pregnant. Anytime there's a pregnancy at the aquarium, it's always big news and a time for joy and anticipation. But this pregnancy is different. There are no other stingrays in Charlotte's tank and only sharks. An expert said it would be impossible for a shark to mate with a stingray, which leaves only the possibility of parthenogenesis. It's a type of asexual reproduction in which offspring develop from unfertilized eggs, meaning there's no genetic contribution by a male. Well, she knocked up herself, I guess. All right, it's time for birthdays.